CKUT 90.3 FM.
The March 11th edition of Gray Matters. Tonight from Alternative Radio, we have a lecture by Ralph Nader entitled Corporatism's Threat to Democracy. It was a lecture delivered in Winsted, Connecticut on February 27th of this year. At the end of tonight's show, we'll give you all the particulars so you can obtain a copy of tonight's show or a transcript of it. So without any further ado, here's tonight's lecture by Ralph Nader, entitled Corporatism's Threat to Democracy.
The minimum wage is frozen at $7.25 an hour. That's corporatism. The tax code allows corporations to escape paying taxes to support our country, our public services. That's corporatism. Corporations inflict corporate crime on consumers. That's corporatism. They block access to courts by restricting the law of torts for millions of wrongfully injured people. That's corporatism. We've got to get used to that word.
That's Ralph Nader, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Ralph Nader on corporatism's threat to democracy. Milton Friedman is the godfather of modern conservative economics. A Nobel Prize winner, his ideas informed what is called the Chicago School. He laid the groundwork for Reagan-era neoliberalism with his landmark essay, The Social Responsibility of Business is to Increase Its Profits. That's pretty straightforward. Make as much money as you can. Society? Well, it can take care of itself. In the decades since Friedman's influential essay, concentrated monopoly corporate power has evolved into corporatism. What is it? Ralph Nader describes it as the commercialization of just about everything at the expense of our civilization's civic, spiritual, health, and safety values. It's crushing our democracy and corrupting our elections. And to talk about corporatism's threat to democracy is Ralph Nader, a legendary figure. He's spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. The Atlantic named him one of the 100 most influential figures in U.S. history. He's the author of many books, including Breaking Through Power. I talked with him on February 27th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
Now, Biden's appointments and policy announcements since the January 20th inauguration, what do you like and what don't you like so far?
Well, in the first flush of his administration after January 20th, all of us obviously felt a sense of relief. So he had an easy act to follow. If he didn't do what Trump did, that is insult everybody and tweet by the hour and lie by the hour, he came out pretty good. So he had the right tone. He did raise the issue of expanding the response to the federal government on the COVID-19 pandemic, coordinating with the states and expanding various medical services. So that was a plus, and that's ongoing. The vaccinations are going up, and the Health Research Group of Public Citizen has looked into the data and everything and have decided that that's a good thing given the cost benefits. So that's one. The second, he completely reversed Trump on climate disruption, a climate crisis, by reestablishing federal research in the area, getting rid of the taboos on even using the word climate change that Trump imposed on federal civil service. And in other ways, connected with the Paris Climate Accords, which are modest and not bounding, but at least he's connecting with the international community on this and putting the train on the tracks for strengthening regulation. So that's a plus. On the minus side, he's put in, you know, the pretty much Wall Street nominees are sympathetic to Wall Street nominees in some of his agencies, with the exception of Gary Gensler, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates the stock market. He has Wall Street experience. He has regulatory experience under Obama, and he's one of the better ones. The first sign of reversing EPA was good, Environmental Protection Agency. And the nominee, while not the most aggressive, certainly is better, far better than the predecessor. A good nomination was Rohit Chopra, who comes over from the Federal Trade Commission, where he was a commissioner to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which regulates the credit economy, all the fraud and overbilling and fee penalties and deception and all of that, and Wall Street. So that's good, too. We're still waiting for the Food and Drug Administration. There's one good nominee, potential, Josh Sharfstein, but there's one bad one, and she's now high up in the FDA. He's been there for years, very close to drug companies, Dr. Woodcock. We haven't seen the Auto Safety Agency yet or the FAA, but I would say he's a little better than the Obama regime that he was a vice president of. Military budget looks like more of the same. He hasn't suggested, and nor have the Democrats in Congress, cutting the bloated, wasteful military budget that's draining away public funds for infrastructure and community jobs and repairing America back home. He is very bad on single payer. In fact, by signaling during the campaign, as people remember, he said he'd veto a single payer bill that came to his desk from Congress. Pretty atrocious when you consider over 100,000 Americans, according to a Yale study, die every year because they can't afford health insurance to get diagnosed and treated in time, apart from the enormous billing fraud, waste, corruption, redundancy, bad medicine that characterizes the present corporate-dominated so-called healthcare system. And the worst part of that is he is collaborating with Nancy Pelosi to discourage the rank-and-file House Democrats from signing on again, as they did in the last session of Congress, to Representative Jayapal from Washington State's gold standard single-payer bill. Here's how bad it is. She announced in January that she would release the co-signers February 1st with the bill. She put the bill in the hopper. And she hasn't done that because the House Speaker is telling House Democrats, focus on expanding, modestly I might say, Obamacare, and don't focus on single payer. So she doesn't want to release this bill with fewer co-signers than occurred under Trump now that there's a Democratic president. See what happens? She had over 130 House Democrats sign on in 2019, and it was H.R. 676. It's got a new bill number now. But she doesn't want to come forward with, say, 80. When people say, what, 80? And you got a Democrat in the White House? So Biden's very bad on that. I think that on infrastructure, he's going to try to push a bill through. On the COVID-19 stimulus, he's going to get that through under the reconciliation where it just needs 51 votes in the Senate. It's already passed the House. And that has a lot of good immediate relief aspects to state, local government, to clinics, and of course, expanding federal unemployment compensation benefits and direct checks to tens of millions of people. He's got to fund the IRS, so the IRS has budget to collect some of the $400 to $600 billion they estimate in uncollected taxes, over 80% of which come from corporate tax evasion, especially the global corporations. There aren't anywhere near enough auditors or investigators. And so they're getting a free hand to evade all kinds of taxes that could lead to infrastructure jobs in the community. He has done nothing on that yet. people are stunned that the budget of the IRS to collect trillions of dollars annually is less than the cost of one aircraft carrier. It ran between $11 and $12 billion a year. So a lot of corporations and super rich are getting away with not paying their legal fair share of taxes. He has not extended his pledge during the campaign to restore the Trump tax cuts, which are running at $2 trillion over 10 years. So there's a lot of question marks, but we can't measure Biden by Trump. We have to measure Biden by civic standards of justice, civic standards of respecting posterity and waging peace instead of waging war.
You've long been a critic of Big Pharma. How have they performed during this pandemic in terms of developing accessible and affordable vaccines?
Well, these corporate capitalist giant drug companies are desperately seeking socialism. Pfizer got almost $2 billion in advance payments for drugs before they were even emergency approved. And they're being charged now, the government is being charged excessively for each vaccine shot, probably twice as much as Moderna and Pfizer should be charged. So these are government-subsidized development of vaccines against COVID-19 virus, and to speed it up and to allow people to go to clinics and hospitals and drug chains and get it free. They don't really have to pay out of pocket. The taxpayer pays. So what's not to like with Joe Biden from the drug companies? And in addition, years ago, most people don't know this, Congress passed an immunity bill. So for vaccine manufacturers who are racing to develop the vaccine, they knew in the last year or so that they could never be sued if there is a bad, negligent, adverse reaction due to gross negligence or carelessness. So you can't sue the drug companies. There's a very tiny nonprofit fund that the legislation years ago set up. 75 cents of every vaccine shot goes into a nonprofit fund for anybody who loses their life or has direct connection adverse effects to the vaccines. It's a fairly high standard proof compared to Europe, by the way.
Now, the pandemic has exposed huge fissures in American society, not just 500,000 dead, and we're well on our way to surpassing the 1918 pandemic death toll of 675,000 people. The numbers are astonishing when you think about the U.S. having only 4% of the world's population, yet it has 20% of the global deaths. What accounts for that?
Trump's virus. First of all, Trump denied that it was going to be much of anything. Then he said, well, it'll just be 15, 20. Then he said, it's not much more than a flu. It's going to go away miraculously. He refused to wear masks. He encouraged his people not to wear masks. He joked about it. He harassed scientists like Dr. Fauci, even at press conferences. He bullied the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in not being candid with the American people. He said he didn't want to alarm the people when he was caught lying to them in April, saying, don't worry, there's nothing to worry about, when his own internal advisors told him there was a lot to worry about. So a lot of these deaths can be attributed to Trump. And the second is too much money into the military-industrial complex. We're going blowing up places all over the third world, creating more enemies and boomerangs and insecurity, huge loss of civilian life, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, completely illegal and unconstitutional, and the wreckage continues to this very day, instead of investing in public health and safety in the U.S. Talk about national security. So we weren't ready with federal infrastructure, with stockpiles of personal protective equipment like masks and gloves. We still import all the gloves that are used for the pandemic from abroad, places like Italy. We can't even produce our own gloves. Ventilator shortages and very low budgets for the state departments of public health in our 50 states, and Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and elsewhere. So are we going to learn the lessons? Well, only if the people mobilize, we're back to the people again, right? I mean, to know and not to do is not to know. That was a very wise saying by a prominent Chinese philosopher in the 14th century Ming Dynasty. And we're full of knowledge we don't use, full of problems we don't deserve. And we've got to do more than talk. Talk is cheap without action. And there's simply not enough connection between all the progressive magazines and progressive talk radio and the citizens listening out there saying, hey, we're going to start Congress watchdogs. We're going to have a letterhead. Nobody can stop us. We're going to get enough names so we can summon our senators and representatives to our own town meetings with our own agendas face-to-face after the COVID, virtual during the COVID. People don't know their own power, David. They don't know. They start out with we the people, not we the Congress, not we the corporation. They start out with owning the greatest wealth in the country, the public wealth of the public airways, the public lands, onshore, offshore, trillions of dollars of their taxes that built industry, aerospace, pharmaceutical, nanotech, biotech, Silicon Valley, internet, computer. It was all built. The basic research and development was done by you, the taxpayer. So what are you getting in return? So we got to wake up. It doesn't take more than 1% of the people, sometimes a lot less. We did it regulating the auto industry by Congress in the 60s with less than 1,000 people around the country. We had the facts. We knew what we were talking about. We had the public behind us, and we knew where to focus our energy, not up in the ether with a march or rally, important as they are, but zeroing in on the key members of Congress who controlled the committees and were persuaded to regulate for the first time the biggest industry in America. So we've got to do that. And if people go to my website, Nader.org, they'll not only get my weekly column free, but they'll get evidence they'll get information on how to mobilize and how to form these Congress Watch locals. I did it in my book, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think.
Indeed. Is it your view that the Sanders-AOC wing of the Democratic Party, the Green New Deal, has essentially been sidelined by the liberals in the administration?
Yes, in terms of using the phrase and in terms of going full blast. Now, obviously, the Biden administration is more pro-solar and more wind power than Trump, who wanted nuclear and coal and oil and gas. So part of the Green New Deal will be part of the energy policy under the Biden administration. The former governor of Michigan, Granholm, is now the new energy secretary, a breath of fresh air, again, compared to her predecessor. And so we'll get a greater emphasis. But how fast will it be? We don't have that many decades, and we need to move fast in displacing fossil fuel nuclear with solar and energy conservation.
Given the well-documented record of indifference, ineptitude, the mountain of mendacities, and some would say, I think you might even say, criminality of the 45th president, the question arises, how did 74 million Americans vote for him? And it's probably likely that had there been no pandemic, he would have been reelected.
Excellent point. I was looking just recently at the voting statistics, and if 45,000 votes switched in three states to Trump, total 45,000 out of 158 million or so votes in Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia, he would have tied Biden with 270 electoral college votes. It would have gone to the House of Representatives. They have to vote state by state, and Republicans control more states. And so he would have been reelected without even going to the House of Representatives. If you add one more state and 40 or 50,000 more votes, so you're still under 100,000 more votes switching. If you added one more state, and that state would have been Nevada, he'd have been elected for a four-year term. This Democratic Party could barely defend the country against a monstrous repetition of four more years of Trump and his Trump warlords savaging our federal government and selling it to Wall Street and the highest corporate bidders. That's how close we came. So it behooves the Democrats to start looking themselves in the mirror and asking why they came so close to disaster when they had all the money in the world. They had more money, campaign money, than the Republicans. And they had $150 million in two relatively small states, Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell was running for reelection, the majority leader of the Senate, and South Carolina, where that travesty called Lindsey Graham was running for re-election. And they lost. The Democrats lost big. One of them spent $80 million, and the other spent $70 million. And they don't even have a look back to see what went wrong so it doesn't go wrong again in 2022 and 2024.
How did 74 million Americans vote for him?
Yes.
Why were people so gullible?
Well, there's an explanation, and it's multifaceted, as to why 74 million Americans voted for Donald J. Trump. So here are some of the reasons. One of them is almost never mentioned, and that is hereditary Republicans. Tens of millions of hereditary Republicans will vote for the Republican nominee, regardless of who that nominee is. As Mayor Bloomberg once said when he decided not to run for president years ago, he said, listen, 15% of the Democrats would vote for the Democrats if Ayn Rand was the nominee, and 15% of the Republicans would vote for Republicans if Leon Trotsky was the nominee. Those are his words. But clearly, probably 30, 40 million would vote Republican ticket regardless, absolutely regardless. Or how about the rest? The rest are people who are largely single or double or triple issues only. So they have low expectations of what this most powerful person in the world can do for their children, for the environment, for peace, for tax equity, for rebuilding and repairing America, for consumer protection, for worker rights and living wage and full health insurance. All that they don't care about. Here's what they care about, and here's what Trump gave them. One, tax cut. Even though it was a tax cut for the rich, they believed his lies and thought it was a tax cut for themselves. Number two, deregulation. Even though deregulation harmed them by exposing them to more pollution, less protection for their children from pesticides, for example, all kinds of harm, regardless of whether they were Trump voters or Biden voters, they all bleed the same way, being ripped off by credit card companies, insurance companies, banks, mortgage service firms, all the fine print contracts. They loved his talk about deregulation. And the third that they bought into was that he was opposed to abortion. Here's this consummate philanderer who knows he was for years for abortion. But, you know, they said, well, we're holding him to his word. And he did pursue policies against reproductive rights. The fourth probably got a few million votes on belligerent talk overseas when he would talk about wiping a country off the map and expanding the military budget beyond what the generals themselves asked.
What about Supreme Court justices and the other justices that he's appointed, several hundred? Wasn't that a factor?
Yes, I neglected to mention that. He came through. He appointed three of the most reactionary judges you could conceive of in the United States. Got him confirmed with Mitch McConnell in the Senate. They now have a 6-3 majority for many years to come. In that sense, he fulfilled his pledge. So you take all these issues and you can see why 74 million people, a record turnout for a president, voted for Trump. And by the way, you know, the population keeps growing. So the fact that he got more votes than Mitt Romney, part of that was due to the expansion of the electorate. But there is another factor that almost never is talked about, and that is after the election in November, it was noted by the vote counters that he did better among Hispanics and Black Americans than it was expected for him to do. People couldn't figure that out. There were some theories, but they didn't seem to have evidence. Well, Tom Hartman came up with the evidence. He's the, as you know, progressive syndicated talk radio host, and he has been listening to Hispanic radio shows that have been overtaken with right-wing Hispanic radio talk show hosts, like Hispanic Sean Hannity's and Rush Limbaugh and Levin and Savage, that are beginning to dominate Hispanic radio. So let's not underestimate the transformation of millions of Reagan Democrats years ago with the rise of Rush and Sean Hannity and others after the Fairness Doctrine was repealed by the first George Herbert Walker Bush's Federal Communications Commissioners. So we have to look carefully at that, and indeed, to see whether it's beginning to occur in the Black media as well. We're not talking about large percentages here, but, you know, if Trump got 10% more Hispanic votes than he was expected to get, that's pretty worrisome for the Democratic Party going toward 2022.
You're listening to Ralph Nader on Corporatism's Threat to Democracy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For CDs of this program and Nader's book, Breaking Through Power, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. We're offering free of charge MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Our website, alternativeradio.org. Well, there's a lot of things that Democrats should be worried about. I mean, you know American political history, particularly electoral history, having participated in it directly yourself. But what is really curious and is a mystery to me, and maybe you have some insight into this, is to why didn't Biden have any coattails? He won the popular vote by more than 7 million. I don't recall anything like that in U.S. political history. This is very ominous for the Democrats in the 2022 midterms coming up.
Well, that's again, the Democrats don't do the kind of post-election self-assessment that the Republicans do when they lose elections. They're very arrogant. They don't return calls by progressives to the Democratic National Committee. The House Democratic Caucus is hard to reach. They don't seek out advice. They keep losing elections or not winning ones they should win in a landslide to the worst Republican Party in history. They have the same consultants who make huge amounts of money, 15% of all the TV ads. So they discourage the Democratic candidates from having a ground game. They say you got to go on television, you got to go on social media so they can get the 15% commission. And as a result, the Biden victory was not matched. They lost two or three seats in California. Biden won California in a landslide. Another reason is gerrymandering. Gerrymandering puts up a resistance wall favoring the Republican state government-controlled gerrymandering people. And so gerrymandering doesn't keep Biden from piling up votes. It keeps Republicans picking their own voters by these crazily shaped congressional districts in order to maximize their representation in Congress. For example, 60% of the vote, roughly, in Pennsylvania was Democrat, and yet the majority of representatives in the House of Representatives from Pennsylvania are Republicans. That's what gerrymandering does.
I believe that's repeated in many districts across the country.
It is. But there's a bright light in Michigan. There's a 27-year-old young woman. Her name is Fahey. Decided she wanted to have a statewide initiative to get rid of gerrymandering in Michigan, because she's pretty outraged, you know, majority Democrat voters, and then, you know, they get a majority Republicans in the House of Representatives. Now, listen, she's 27. She has no money, no contacts, huge energy. So she starts petitions, starts getting signatures to get a nonpartisan redistricting commission to take over instead of the politicians in Lansing, dominated gerrymandered style by Republicans. So she starts getting thousands of signatures, tens of thousands. She starts getting hundreds of volunteers. She starts getting money, people sending in small checks, donations. She starts getting the attention of some big donors. She ends up raising $15 million. This is 2 years ago. And she wins the election. She won the initiative. And now, very shortly, a nonpartisan commission will be redrawing more rationally, more fairly, more democratically, small d, the congressional districts in Michigan. Talk about one person making a difference. I said to her on my little radio program, the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, I said, are you going to advise people in other states? I mean, if you pulled it off in Michigan, starting with no contacts and no money, you've got a lot of advice to give to people in other states. And I asked her, are you getting national publicity? No. The national media pretty much ignored her. That's why programs like yours are so important. Can you imagine a win like this right in the white heat of national elections and congressional elections? And she doesn't get on national TV?
Amazing, indeed. Let's talk about the January 6th insurrection. Were you at all surprised at what happened? And also the question about how was this organized? Who paid for it? The Guardian, the venerable British newspaper, said it was enabled by very deep pockets. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah, I mean, some of them are just Republican donors, big Republican donors. They basically thought it was going to be a big rally to put all these people on the mall. So no one can determine right now, short of further investigation, that they were funding an insurrection. But that's what occurred. Now, obviously, there were organized people, given the weapons they brought on and the arrests that have been made so far. They were organized for trouble. They had weaponry. They had all kinds of crude type things that they were wielding. They had bear spray, pepper spray. So they knew what they were doing when they were heading to Congress.
How concerned are you? How concerned should we be about such groups as the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, and Three Percenters who follow QAnon and depend on One America News Network and Newsmax?
Well, we should be very concerned if Trump remains their leader and provocateur and supporter. Without Trump, they don't get all the media. They don't get the legitimacy. They don't get the dog whistles. They don't get the partisan law enforcement people to look the other way because they're Trumpsters at heart. So if Trump is retired from politics and he doesn't have that kind of direct media, the more extreme groups will be exposed without a political base. And if they engage in more violence, then they will be subject to normal prosecution by regular police and Justice Department. The Justice Department is now obviously going to be much more their adversary and investigator than it was under William Barr and Donald Trump.
It's interesting to see how the lexicon is changing. Discussions about systemic racism rather than a one-off random acts of cruelty. White supremacy is now often talked about as well.
Well, I think we should talk as much about corporatism. Corporatism over the decades. Obviously, there was corporatism with cotton plantation corporations having black slaves. Corporatism creates economic and political conditions, money and corrupt politics, for example. It creates economic and political conditions, expanding racism, expanding lack of equity of pay of women, expanding so many of the things that we don't connect to the concentration of giant political and economic power in the hands of global corporations who have turned government against its own people and created a corporate state, which has been underway for many years under both Democrat and Republican administrations. In fact, in 1938, Franklin Delano Roosevelt sent a message to Congress, and in his message, he said, whenever government power is controlled by private power, that's fascism, otherwise known as corporate control over government, you know, through elections and infiltrations and bribery and so on, and turning government against its own people. So that is where I think we should add another ism and talk about corporatism creating authoritarian government that doesn't serve the people. And the poor and minorities take the brunt, but everyone takes a brunt. And the enormous contribution to deprivation and poverty that comes from corporate control and super wealthy control of our income levels, our wealth, and the suppression of voters, especially low-income voters, and above all, the suppression of worker rights. I mean, workers today, there are millions of workers making less in real inflation dollars than they made in 1968. I mean, just imagine. The minimum wage is frozen at $7.25 an hour. That's corporatism. That's Walmartism. The tax code allows corporations to escape paying taxes to support our country and our public services. That's corporatism. Corporations inflict corporate crime on consumers, on people who deserve their full pension by ripping off pensions. They abuse worker safety by generating unsafe workplaces. That's corporatism. They block access to courts by restricting the law of torts for millions of wrongfully injured people. That's corporatism. They destroy our freedom of contract by making a sign on the dotted line or click on horribly one-sided fine print contracts that take away our rights and prevent us from even going to court. When we're wrongfully injured, we're told we agreed on page 13 to waive our rights for a jury trial, to waive our liability rights, to waive our rights to have an open trial against people who stole from us, billing fraud, or injured us with hazardous pharmaceuticals, defective motor vehicles, unsafe Boeing 737 Maxes. That's corporatism. We've got to get used to that word. Confucius, over 2,000 years ago, we should listen to him. He said, you have to start with the right language if you want to connect with reality.
We have a NASA rover called Perseverance exploring Mars right now. While back here on Earth, things are falling apart. people freezing to death in Texas, homes damaged and destroyed, lives ruined. That's quite a paradox.
Well, it's a tremendous paradox. First, you have to be unbelievably impressed by the precision that they have constructed this rover called Perseverance. It not only gets to Mars flawlessly, but it hovers over Mars, getting sensors over how firm the surface is here, how less firm it is there, how undulating it is over here, so it can figure out the best place to land. And we can't clean up contaminated drinking water for millions of people in the United States of America. I mean, we have the ways to detect lead, to detect levels of arsenic, to detect other heavy metals. It's not that we don't have the equivalent of NASA technology here on Earth. It's that we don't have the democratic power, the people power, to use it to sweep aside these corrupt politicians and these corporate polluters and say, we're going to use our tax dollars for our clean drinking water systems all over America.
What role did deregulation factor in the debacle in Texas?
Huge. What happened was that the Republican corporatist legislature wanted to have their own independent grid, electric grid, the Lone Star State coming alive again. Rugged individualism. So they got the Republican administration and the Democrat administration in Washington to let them have an independent grid that is not connected to other grids in other states. So if you have a shortage in Texas, you can draw on the grid from other states. Well, you know what happened. Everybody knows what happened. Along comes this Arctic storm, and you get freezing of pipes, you get infrastructure that has not been maintained because Texas is a low tax state, right? Come to Texas, pay low taxes. Like there's no price to pay for that. Look what happened in the last few weeks, huh? And above all, they didn't weatherproof the pipelines as they are in other states. You know, why have taxes for that? Say the tax escapees in Austin. And they didn't weatherproof even the wind power blades like they do, say, in North Dakota and elsewhere, you know, in Kansas. That's what deregulation does. Deregulation is a word for let the corporations do whatever they do for profit, no matter how many people die, get sick, get injured, or get ripped off in their family budget. And now they're paying 4, 5, 6 times for their electric bill. I don't know how long that's going to last for households in Texas. So the question is, are the Democrats going to get wise here and mobilize the votes and replace the Texas legislature? Well, they didn't in 2020. They didn't in 2018. They have plenty of material to work with. And now they have Mother Nature, which has come to their rescue. Let's see what you do. I talked to Jim Hightower and said, this is the greatest opportunity for Democrats you can imagine. While Ted Cruz was acquitting Trump one week, the next week he was quitting Texas for Cancun. And while Beto, his challenger in 2018, was passing out bottled water with his sleeves rolled up, helping with relief efforts. So let's see what happens.
That was Beto O'Rourke. Elon Musk is competing with Jeff Bezos as the richest person on Earth. He took the Texas low tax bait and moved a major Tesla factory from the San Francisco Bay Area to Texas. But speaking of cars, it's the 55th anniversary of your landmark book, Unsafe at Any Speed. More than 4 million lives have been saved because of auto safety measures that you proposed. What about the state of auto safety today?
Well, it was put to sleep under Clinton, Bush, Obama, and, of course, Trump. But it looks like now that we're going to get a better administrator under Biden. He's already retained a very progressive general counsel for the Auto Safety Agency under the Department of Transportation. We're not going to have a right-wing corporatist as Secretary of Transportation. Pete Buttigieg is Secretary of Transportation. And there's a lot of long-delayed recalls, a lot, including a very thorough recall of Takata airbags. That's still unfinished business, millions of cars, and with the right fix. And, of course, updating older auto safety standards for truck brakes, for tires, for handling, vehicle handling, rollover, side protection, up the standards for airbags, and things that, you know, are well known. They're practical and ready to go. The automotive suppliers have been begging the auto companies to do it. They're the innovators, by the way, the automotive suppliers, the corporations selling to the auto industry. Tiger Woods was in a serious single car crash not long ago, and the police looked at the vehicle after the collision and said that nobody could have survived that crash without multiple airbags going off from the steering wheel area and from the side area. What was exposed to the collision forces were his legs and ankles, and those were his major injuries. So there you go. All over America, people are benefiting from the regulation of the 60s and early 70s, and especially under Joan Claybrook, under Carter, from 76 to 1980, before Reagan put the auto agency on the shelf. A cruel man with a smile, I might add. And so it looks like better days ahead for auto safety protection for the American people, for higher fuel efficiency standards. And it's corollary: when you have more fuel efficiency in your car, you have lower pollution emissions.
I noticed in Breaking Through Power, you quoted a wonderful poem written by Marge Piercy called The Low Road. I was wondering if you had that handy and you could read it.
Okay, here's the poem. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care. To act, it starts when you do it again. And they said no. It starts when you say, we. And know who you mean. And each day you mean one more, end quote. And Howard Zinn liked that because he said, quote, small acts when multiplied by millions of people can quietly become a power no government can suppress, a power that can transform the world, end quote. And that goes with the point of my book, Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think. Almost every social justice movement in our country's history, short of wars like the Revolution, Civil War, was accomplished by less than 1% of active citizens linked together. The Civil Rights Movement, the Populist Progressive Movement, the Women's Right to Vote Movement, the Anti-Slavery Movement, apart from the Civil War, those never had more than 1%, but they had two other things. They knew what they were talking about, and they had public opinion on their side because they were morally and democratically right. And they focused that energy on the decision makers, which very often is the U.S. Congress and state legislatures and city council. So they marched, they protested, they rallied, but they didn't let that civic energy peter out into the ether. They turned it around and laser beamed it, focused on two senators and representatives, like the environmental movement in 1970, 71, 72. Never took more than 1%. And that gives people a lot of optimism because we grow up being educated to be powerless, to exaggerate the overwhelming power of the big boys And it's just not true. If people, starting with we the people, we're the sovereign. The Constitution says so. It's a good start. We would really realize the extent of our own powers and how fast we can turn things around for living wage, full health insurance, cleaner environment, renewable energy, clean elections, waging peace around the world, protecting our posterity, giving people access to justice for their personal grievances. All of this, I hate to say the phrase, but once 1% of the people organize in these electoral districts and they open up little offices with their volunteer donations for full-time people, focusing on very small number of people, 535 members of the Congress, a few hundred people in your state legislature. Once they do that and they realize there's a left-right alliance on so many things where people work, live, and raise their family, this red state, blue state doesn't operate for living wage. This conservative liberal doesn't really operate for having universal health care with free choice of doctor and hospital, not breaking your life savings or being denied life-saving health care. It doesn't work for repairing the local main street and the public services of the country. It doesn't work for cleaning up water and air pollution. There's no red state, blue state. There's no liberal, conservative polarization. It's a 70 to 80% support in the polls. And once people realize that, then it comes down to piece of cake. We got the auto industry regulated in less than a year after Unsafe at Any Speed came out in November of 1965. I was at the White House with Lyndon Johnson. He gave me a pen. We regulated the greatest powerful industry in America for the first time for safety standards, for pollution control, and for fuel efficiency. We had less than 1,000 people around the country helping us. You mentioned the number of lives averted, over 4 million, but there are tens of millions of injuries prevented. And think of the family anguish that was prevented. And think of the billions of dollars in waste and health costs that was prevented. I think if people realize how easy it is, they will be much more likely to get civically engaged, to turn out, to show up, to petition, to lobby, especially if they come forward with a right-left coalition, which I discuss in this book, Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think.
We're going to wind up, Ralph, now. You've been at it for so many decades. You're a role model for many and the very definition of indefatigability. What keeps you going?
Well, by being active, there's nothing worse than retirement. You know that. You're never going to retire. The only real aging is the erosion of one's ideals. Those aren't my words. I can't recall who actually said them. But it keeps you vibrant, keeps your mind active. The other is a fervent desire for justice. I never liked bullies when I was growing up. I couldn't stand a fifth grader beating up a third grader, and I would intervene. And that sort of stayed with me when I had to confront corporate bullies or political bullying. And I think I also it's just updating constantly what I and my associates, they used to be called Nader's Raiders, nobody does it by themselves. We had thousands of young people and not so young people with task forces doing investigations of government agencies like the Department of Agriculture and the banking commissioners. And we had books, groundbreaking books, when publishers would rush to print them, and we would update them.
Well, Ralph, on behalf of many out there in Radio Land, the Alternative Radio Network, want to thank you for your decades of service and wish you a very happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's the same birthday as Longfellow. Longfellow had his birthday on the 27th of February. Thank you very much, David.
Thanks very much, Ralph. That was Ralph Nader on Corporatism's Threat to Democracy. I talked with him on February 27th. Ralph Nader, a legendary figure, has spent a lifetime fighting on behalf of ordinary people. The Atlantic named him one of the 100 most influential figures in U.S. history. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 35th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, where we have more than 20 programs featuring Ralph Nader, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of today's program, Ralph Nader on Corporatism's Threat to Democracy, and Nader's book, Breaking Through Power, just give us a call at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. We're offering free of charge MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to City Lights Books. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Lebanese oud virtuoso Marcel Khalife performing Takassim.
So that concludes this week's edition of Gray Matters. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation from Alternative Radio down in Boulder, Colorado. You can check out their website at www.alternativeradio.org. Coming up on CKUT is Dromotext in an hour of spoken word recordings, and we'll get to it after a little bit of station business. Till next week.
Stone blows. Forced to go toe-to-toe, blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. Vilified by all sides, vilified for small crimes. Forced to go blow for blow in a war zone with only stones to throw. We're gonna break. We're gonna break. We're gonna break. We're gonna break. The game hasn't changed, same old monopoly. Same couple players on all the property. I ain't a prop, don't get no props to me. My people still don't need property. Think we forgot, we was just property. Think we'll be bought again, think that they brought them democracy. I think they brought back them poppies. These my people locked up and chopping. That's hypocrisy, we wasn't thought of. We wasn't brought up and taught, we was set up. That's why we get caught up, y'all discarded us. Put them bars up, of course we got bars up. We hard cause we hard up, they got them startups and Starbucks. We got a couple of stars, so they turn them to starters. They starve us, can't even drink water. Up north with that Flint water, all in the sink. Cause they see for the kids on the brink. Y'all went to Harvard and Stanford, think harder for answers. Man, think, we're far below standards. Don't tell me anger won't help us. You told me the cancer would shrink. We need to shrink. We just see boys making bands and sink. Open your eyes, my fam. We all could be gone in a blink. Change, same game of life we play. Maybe I'm only one roll of the dice away from a rose with some ices and gold on the license plate. We roll a whole life away. I think they gamers, may just be gamers.
the system, they made it to play us. Gave us controllers, we gave no control up. The game wasn't made, so we make it, it's made up. It's what if they're waving, just look at these wages they pay us. It's pennies, it pains us, they paint us in corners on corners. What can we do, man, we're cornered. I'm lucky I'm stuck in this booth, stuck here all cooped up. People get stuck up for loot, stuck up in...
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hey, good evening, and welcome to this week's edition of Dromatext, another COVID-19 edition set recorded at home. We're going to be listening to the poems of Wanda Coleman tonight, a few by Eileen Miles, and we'll finish up the show with something by Deanne De Prima. Wanda Coleman, the late Wanda Coleman, hailed from Los Angeles, an extraordinary poet, and we'll be listening to some of her readings and interview that she did from the radio station in Southern California. Here she is, Wanda Coleman.
Ethelbert Miller, who's a mutual friend, says that American poets are all children of Walt Whitman, and you would consider yourself in that lineage.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us why.
Well, I think because I'm a part of the chorus that sing in America, you know, that song of ourselves. I'm a child of Whitman in a pragmatic sense, that poetry, poets are not businessmen, but we're forced often in a position to represent ourselves in that arena, to dicker for the check, to find ways of, new ways of patronage to support what we do, filling out grantsmanship applications after application, sitting on panels, entering the university system.